short stories about big change. This is Coming Around.
Hi, Lara. How are you?
Hi, Joey. I'm good. How are you?
Oh my gosh, I'm so good. I wondered if you wanted to start by maybe explaining a little bit about how you and I know each other.
Yeah, of course. We have quite a long history, don't we?
Oh my gosh, yes.
We met as teenagers in high school and experienced just life as you do as a teenager, sort of me-centric, eye-focused. We grew up a little bit. We've run into one another and crossed paths through our hometown several times, but we haven't seen one another in, 10 years?
Yeah, at least. I remember we saw each other at the store once, and it was like such a fun blast from the past. And I think it's actually part of our distance over the last few years and your willingness to do this that I'm most excited about, actually. I think that, you know, we follow each other on social media, but I haven't heard your perspective in a long time. And so I'm just really excited to get into it. So I also wanted to start by saying that I posted on social media maybe a few weeks ago now asking about, hey, does anyone have any interesting stories of something that they've come around on or an interesting perspective they would like to share about their life and what they've been going through over the last couple of years? And you reached out. So would you mind telling me a little bit about that or telling us a little bit about that?
I'd be happy to. I think it starts for me with adult experiences that I've had just around different ideologies, you know, not political necessarily, just perspective differences. You know, we're all open to the things that we're comfortable with and less open to things we aren't. And the catalyst for me was the 2016 election. I realized very poignantly how different I was. I was on a jury, and some of my fellow jury folk were not of the same ideologies, were not of the same backgrounds, and just had really interesting political opinions as that election occurred. It was juxtaposed with a drunk driving accident that was really awful that we were on the jury for. So it was very surreal, just all around. And I had to wrap up because professionally I had to get on a plane at the end of this jury trial and it had to end on November 15th. And I had to go to New Orleans for a conference and a really important meeting for one of my projects professionally. It did. But that flight, as I got on the plane, I just couldn't stop thinking about these people that I was so different from on the jury trial. And I grew up in, or I worked in a place that was, you know, California, Los Angeles, so progressive, very open. But I had encountered people who were still really different from me, and I do consider myself a progressive.
Yeah. I'm curious about what you recognized, and maybe you'll get to this. I'm curious about what you recognized in that jury room or wherever you were socializing with them that made it so stark, that made your differences so stark with theirs.
Yeah, you know, I think the thing for me was that on this jury, the people that looked like me, that had the same sort of upper middle class background that I had, were voting for Donald Trump and were really vocal advocates for him and against our female political candidate. And the folks that didn't necessarily look like me as far as socioeconomic status, physically, or age-wise, were just a lot more open-minded. And one man in particular, his name was Peter, we developed this sort of bantering friendship. He's about our parents' age. I think he was an aeronautical engineer. And he couldn't understand people that didn't see the world the way that he did. And he was cruel about it. And regularly over lunch, he was really kind of awful to me or to other people about our political ideology. And he would sort of gloat in what he expected the outcome of the election to be and just put us down in a way that I really wasn't comfortable with. I mean, he was a stranger.
And when you say you had banter, what was that like?
You know, at first it was friendly. I think my jury trial started about a week before the election. And so it was kind of getting to know one another in this lunchroom all by ourselves. well, trying to stay away from the topic of our trial and, you know, joking about politics. And, you know, he would sort of poke, you know, I can't vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. And we would poke back, well, we can't vote for someone who, you know, manhandles women, nor should we.
Right.
And it got a little more heated as the election got closer. And the day after the election was just, you know, it was a very somber, very weird day. And he kind of continued to poke people around him, you know, just jubilantly, which, I mean, if you think about it, he was very happy with the outcome of the election and he was celebrating.
Right. Emboldened, even, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also he just didn't understand the implications of his beliefs or his blind spots or his behavior.
That's interesting. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, for this particular man, I believe he lived in a wealthy suburb near Los Angeles, and he had his entire life, and his privilege had put blinders in place where he didn't understand life as a woman. He couldn't understand life as, you know, a Filipino man who was another man who he really razzed on the jury. And he couldn't put himself in those statuses that were not his own and be sympathetic or empathetic. And it was awkward at times and frustrating.
Yeah, I'm like really curious about why he even felt like he could talk to you all as strangers in the ways that he was. Do you have a sense of that?
You know, I think it was the whole jury experience, which I don't know whether or not you've done that. It's an incredible social experiment. So this was a civil jury about money related to a drunk driving accident. And it was a long trial. It was about three and a half weeks.
Oh my God.
Of, you know, 8 to 5 every day with the same people. And then you kind of go home to your personal life and you come back at 8 a.m. the next morning and that's all you do. And so at every break, you know, you're surrounded by these folks. At every lunch, you're surrounded by them and you walk out to your cars together and they kind of become this weird, hyper fast sort of coworker family. My group of jurors kept in touch for, I don't know, about 3 years after the trial.
Oh, wow.
So it was an odd mix. But this particular trial and this experience around the election just really made me chew on things as I went to get on a plane to go to New Orleans. And yeah. I thought, I'm going to Louisiana, which is, you know, an impoverished state, a state where there are a lot of people of all different backgrounds that are really different from mine. I want to see if on this flight I can listen to people, I can hear their perspective, and I can just not judge them and think about what they have to say and kind of where they want the conversation to go.
I want to go back a little bit because I think that's such interesting fodder for where you were. So you were in this trial or you were on this jury, and then it was in the middle of the election, you started to recognize some social difference between the people who you say looked like you and the people with whom it seemed like you identified who didn't look like you necessarily, who you aligned with politically. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Like, what was that like to be in that room, to be with those people who were on the surface, they might have thought you were kin, they might have thought you were like them, as you say, yet you also identified very much with people who sounds like people of color, sounds like people of varied socioeconomic backgrounds. Like, how did you get to that point? I'm curious about that.
I guess I'm not sure. It was uncomfortable. There was a moment during jury selection. I was sitting next to a man, you know, I'm in my mid-30s. He was in his mid-30s. I'm Caucasian. He's Caucasian. We both have middle-class jobs and sort of traditional middle-class lives, for lack of a better description. And I didn't know him at all. And as they called on me and asked, I can't remember the specific question, but about, you know, how would I feel about someone drinking and driving? Do I think that's wrong? You know, in front of a room full of strangers. And I mean, like most people, I said, of course I think that's wrong. And I think that the law dictates what we should follow regarding drunk driving for a reason. So I would try to make the right decision with that context. And the man next to me got really uncomfortable and he started yelling when he was called on about his experience with a drunk driving crash and losing someone he loved and how could they put him through this experience. And I mean, I could empathize, but I couldn't relate.
Sure.
And he went to this really dark place about, he thinks that people should be really physically punished or put in jail for a really long time. And it's one of the worst things that could happen. And it was one of those of many experiences where I felt really different from someone that on the surface I probably could have related to if I was a different person.
Right. That sounds like such a, it sounds like that person was bringing a lot of personal traumas into that room. And did you say that that person was selected for the jury?
He was not.
Right.
But some of the other jurors that weren't selected, you know, we were all very different. I should say were selected. We were all just very different. You know, there was a woman who was retired, had been a school teacher and a principal, and seemed just like she made very good decisions with the greater good in mind.
Mm.
But the more that I got to know her, what I realized was that in retirement, she was really afraid of her financial situation.
Mm-hmm.
And she was struggling to understand people who came from different walks of life that she felt like were taking things from her.
Oh, wow. So she felt personally almost attacked by what? What were some of those things that she mentioned?
She, again, in the context of the political election, talked a lot about handouts and how she felt like people in Los Angeles back when she was a principal didn't receive the same kind of handouts that they were receiving now. And she was surprised that parents nowadays would come to school with technology, smartphones, devices, but couldn't put food on the table.
So I assume this woman was white, middle class, like you said, middle to upper class, had that sort of perspective on life. Is that your takeaway from her?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was just another experience where I thought maybe if I were different, I could understand. I can certainly understand your suffering, but I can't understand how it's someone else's fault.
Laura, I'm so curious how you, as someone who, you know, you talk about being white, coming from a middle-class background, how did you get to be in the position where you were, where you had these progressive values? Where did your personal values come from so that you were able to even recognize those differences between the other people who seem like you on the surface? Like, what is your background that made that be true for you?
Wow. I don't know. I think it's a lot of factors. It's like the soup that makes me who I am, but I would think public education in kindergarten through high school. I would think, you know, my experience and exposure to trauma and loss. And so having empathy for people who go through any sort of trauma and loss, you know, I lost my dad when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that it would be just having experiences in life that are humbling, and taking away hopefully what I should have, or at least a bite of what I should have from those, you know, getting a dream job and having that dream job disappear in front of me. And having to make ends meet as a freelancer until I could kind of find a new way. Understanding, I think, just the plights of people who are different from me, or being able to listen to them and to think about them and digest them enough to know that that's what suffering looks like, or hardship, or privilege.
Do you come from a family of listeners? Like, would you say that that trait runs in your family?
I think so. My mom is a psychotherapist. My grandmother was a social worker, and my grandfather worked for the United Way.
Wow. A legacy of open-minded people, it sounds like.
So I guess I better do big things with my life, right?
Sounds like you are. I feel like, I mean, you're just bringing such an interesting perspective, and I'm always so curious about people who arrive where they are, especially people who, to be honest, don't necessarily have to. People who occupy in society a lot of privilege, people who occupy a lot of space that doesn't necessarily require them to think of others. And when they do, like you do right now, it's I'm always so curious how you got there. So you're in this jury, you're with these people, it's the election time. Let's come back to where you're headed with this flight. Tell me a little bit about this flight and what inspired you. What were those moments, those sort of like early clicks, like, yeah, I'm going to get on this flight and I'm going to do something different. Tell me about those. Walk me through that thought process.
I think for me, a big part of it was coming out of the election of someone who I consider an extreme misogynist and just, I don't know, bad human being, but ultimately assailant of women pretty routinely. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand how other women could support somebody like that to the point where they would cast their vote in the free world towards someone that did not stand for them, but they still believed in. And I also wanted to understand what the men, you know, the majority of the sort of white, lower middle class, working class men that were supporting somebody like our president, what they were thinking and feeling and how they justified those beliefs to themselves or themselves, because I wanted to understand if there was a way, even just a small way, that I could help them see my experiences and just chew on something after we talked, that I could do that.
Right. Yeah, almost like you were willing to listen to them and hoping that they were willing to listen to you is what it sounds like.
Yeah, or at least hoping that I left some spark that didn't sit and right enough with them that they thought about it again at least a couple times, and maybe then that someone else would do the same thing, and over time we would chip away at their understanding of right and wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious about that because you talk about wanting to be heard, of course, right? That's, I think, a natural part of this process. But also what I found interesting in your initial reach out to me was that you sounded like you wanted to hear as well. Tell me about that. Like, tell me about what it means to you to want to hear from people who, you know, even people who, not just, I'm not the kind of person that says, oh, we just believe differently on this spectrum. I genuinely believe that some beliefs that people hold are at the detriment of the lives and livelihoods of many people in our society. I don't want to imply that I don't believe that.
Agreed.
And I think there's something really interesting about those of us, I'll say, who are deeply curious about learning from that perspective. So tell me a little bit about that for you. What was it about? What did you hope to learn? What were you anticipating you might experience in a new way that would illuminate how you saw those people?
I think I was hoping to learn how I could empathize with someone like that, or how I could set aside the emotional reactions that I had, you know, the anger, the frustration, the sorrow, and see somebody who, for all intents and purposes, a lot of people just bucket into a Trump supporter bucket. Mm. In a human light, right? I work with a lot of people who are progressives who I deeply, deeply respect. And I was in Los Angeles at the time in just a very, very liberal bubble. But what I kept finding is that when you dug beneath the surface, even with people who I knew and respected and agreed with in many, many ways, they too hold strong bias and hate. And I thought, well, if I feel this way about my friends at times, no wonder people are so different and we have two really different groups of ideology, much more so than we have a Venn diagram in today's day and age in any regard. And what can I do to be a part of that middle and to grow the group of people who do listen and do hear and do care and take action because of that?
Right. It's almost like your middle is defined not by idea, not like an ideological middle or a political middle, but a middle ground even, where values are respected and heard and people can bring their wholeness and fullness of their personal identities. And those who are just now or just maybe for the first time exploring what it's like to recognize difference and others have some room there too. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of take away the attack, because I think so often people assume that they will be attacked for something that they stand for or something that they stand against. And they approach a conversation in that way. And so I thought, if I can be a listener, and I mean, it's really tough when you think about somebody telling you something that is racist or is sexist or xenophobic. And I'm sitting next to a stranger who's larger than I am in the air and is already talking heatedly, and you can just tell they're kind of at the edge, having to check myself, but also stay true to what I do believe, because I wasn't going to sit next to someone who, you know, said something really awful and just go, oh, okay, that's nice.
Or that's just their opinion.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something really powerful about taking the attack away. I really value that. And I almost wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. Like, have you seen that from a lot of people? I mean, because you talk about occupying space where maybe people expect certain political leanings from you, or almost like a naivete from you. How have you experienced that attack in other worlds or in other parts of your life?
I think it's interesting because I do benefit from the privilege of, you know, being blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and white.
Mm.
And so sitting next to, you know, a man going to Louisiana who wants to tell me about his hunt is probably a very different experience than some other people would have. But, you know, if you talk to anybody and you're very direct, and I have a sharp tongue at times, you can set somebody on the warpath. And I try to do it a lot less the more I mature. But if somebody gets me going, I still can really push their buttons. Sometimes what you don't know, you know, can set people off. I think we see that today with the coronavirus and all the different stances that people have around it. You know, it's hard to tiptoe around what you don't know when you don't know it.
Right. And I think there's something really interesting too about the confidence that it sounds like you're exuding right now, which is you are an intelligent woman. Obviously, that's been true for as long as I've known you. And still part of that intelligence must express itself in an ability to restrain as well, right? And so yeah. I'm curious about, so you're on this flight and you are, a conversation is being struck up with you regarding a hunt, and you're like, shoot, I can take this one of two ways, right? So tell me about that moment. Like, what do you, how do you react? How do you feel? How do you, especially in the spirit of wanting to engage in this new way?
Yeah, so I could have put my headphones on and turned away and ignored this gentleman. And I should say that I ultimately did end up doing that when I wanted to shut the conversation down for good.
Sure.
But I thought, here's someone who is really different from who I am and most of the people in my life and my periphery from day to day. So I should hear him and I should think about what he has to say. And I'm genuinely curious, you know, why does he feel on an airplane like it's appropriate sitting next to a much younger, not interested stranger to share the news that he's been on an exotic game hunt and it was thrilling and he, you know, had a hookup while he was there.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Not necessarily the thing I would share.
And so okay, so you learned something from him. You've expressed that. But what did you learn from that experience? Like, when you're sort of sitting there, sitting back going like, why me? Why is he talking to me about this? What did you come up with? Like, why you?
I think I'm more friendly, or I appear more friendly than I would like to, is my biggest takeaway.
I've heard that from many women.
But I also think, you know, like, I was thinking about this guy and I actually think about him quite a lot. I don't remember his name. But he had a really complex life and he was a really interesting individual when you set aside just our surface level belief differences. His daughter-in-law was Muslim American. And he actually did talk to me both about how much he loved and respected her. And he gave me her business card. She's a realtor, I think. And told me if I ever needed to buy a house in the part of Louisiana where they live, I could look her up.
Very kind.
But he also had this hatred for people who were not her, or the people that he immediately knew through her, who were taking something from him in his perspective.
What were some of those things?
I can't remember the specifics, if I'm being honest, but they had to do with his economic status and his freedoms and his rights to travel. And you know, we talked a little bit about the pains, I think, of airport security. And he was frustrated by that and sort of blamed that on not all Muslims, but all Muslim Americans, was his specific statement.
Oh, what an that's really interesting.
Yeah. And I, you know, I tried to dig in, and it finally did get to a point where I was uncomfortable enough, and I could tell he was upset enough by my silence instead of agreement, that I did say, you know, something like, oh, I've got to get this project done for work. I'm going to plug in. And I put my headphones on, and you know, he calmed down. I think he had a drink. And by the time we got off the plane, he was chatting with me again about how excited he was to be in New Orleans again and to go see his family and that they would be picking him up. And I think that likely his perspective of our interaction was different from mine.
So, okay, you mentioned that you've thought about him a lot since then. What do you think about? What about that conversation has stuck with you?
I was surprised by his candidness. And I was surprised by the way that he could distance himself from the isms that he was making when he talked about the human that he knew who was one individual. And I think what disappointed me, or what I kind of tried to leave with him, was what if your really lovely daughter-in-law is much more like everybody here that you don't relate to and that you really feel angry about? And that was where the conversation sort of took a turn for the worse. But I wonder if I left that with him, and I wonder if I left any of the, you know, because we talked a little bit just about the appropriateness or non-appropriateness of showing me photos of the woman in the hot tub that he met in the Midwest.
Wow, he showed you pictures.
I saw lots of pictures of exotic game and this individual.
Wow.
And you know, the way I put it was, wow, she's stunning. She's clearly enjoying herself, and it sounds like you were too. I don't know if I were her, though, that I would be comfortable with you showing my photos to a stranger.
You said that?
Yeah.
Wow, what did he say?
And he said, well, I hadn't thought about it that way. Are you uncomfortable? And I said, a little bit. I'm glad she's clothed. And I kind of like giggled. And then I said, okay, I've got to turn back to work.
Wow, that's very courageous of you. How did that feel to do that?
Really, really awkward. And it was just the best reaction I thought I could have given the circumstance to kind of mitigate and end.
What did you want to say?
I think the really frustrated, impulsive side of me wanted to just say, it's super disgusting that you're showing me pictures of a woman that you had a sexual encounter with. That's totally inappropriate on a plane.
Right. I'm a complete stranger. You don't know me at all. Why are you doing this?
Yeah. But I think I could empathize with, you know, in his mind, he was really proud of that experience, and it clearly didn't happen, and it validated something for him, and it wasn't harmless. But I felt like as a woman, it was better to soften and walk away than to push.
That's a really interesting perspective. Do you feel like you would do that now?
It would really, really depend on the context. I've had many, many conversations about this sort of a scenario with girlfriends, you know, with different experiences. And some of my girlfriends agree, some don't. I think some strangers will agree and some won't. I ultimately tend to lean towards survival when I'm in a total fight or flight. But I do have friends who will tell people at a bar, I'm just not interested because you seem like a pig.
Right.
And, you know, consequences be damned.
Did you feel in a fight or flight mode on the plane?
I mean, not a heightened where I felt like something really awful would happen to me, but I also thought I probably shouldn't continue to poke the bear.
Right. It sounds like that. Like it was almost inching toward you in some way. That, like, listening to the story, it feels like he was testing the waters to see how you would respond.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds pretty scary. I'm sorry that happened.
I guess I didn't think of it that way.
Okay, so you're getting off the plane. What are those first few thoughts that you had? Not just about him, but about how you chose to interact.
You know, I think it was, would I have had the same conversation? Where might I have tried to redirect the discussion? And I think a little later on, I thought, did I listen enough? You know, did I ask the right questions? You know, what am I hoping to get out of these conversations? Because clearly I don't want to put myself in a dangerous or an uncomfortable situation. I don't want a stranger to make a pass at me in an inappropriate way. But I wasn't sure I had gotten what I thought I would get out of the conversation. I think I thought we would have more conversation just around politics and around beliefs, and that somehow I would magically come away with a better sort of instant understanding. And I think that was the very first time I had that sort of a conversation. And I realized that I was in it for the long game and not the short reward.
Right. I'm curious, like, what kind of short reward did you think was going to come?
Yeah, I think I had hoped that he would go, oh, you're right. I had never thought about it that way. That is a woman's perspective. And I should really think about that more. And that was definitely not what happened. And I think I hoped that, you know, I would find someone who was, you know, clearly in the camp of Make America Great Again. And he would hear what I had to say as I was hearing what he had to say. And I think I had to realize that that just wasn't going to happen most of the time, or maybe even ever.
So, I mean, this begs the question, what's the long game for you? How has that transitioned into your long-term outlook or your long-term plan? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. I live now in Albuquerque, which is much more divided politically. People live in a different type of poverty here than they do in Los Angeles, in my opinion. And people grow up with different levels of education that are much more varied than what I experienced in my bubble in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to my right, I have progressive, fantastic, educated neighbors. And to my left, I have neighbors who really raise themselves up by their bootstraps, but don't want that success for anyone who is not also white and that sort of purebred version of an American that they see.
Is that literal? Are those actually your neighbors?
Those are actually my neighbors.
Oh, that is so interesting.
It is a total trip.
The neighbors get along?
You know, I don't know if they interact with one another ever. I do know that my very Make America Great Again neighbors do not like our progressive end of street neighbor. They regularly get in yelling battles about their political signs.
Wow.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what I hoped, and moving back to a place like this, what I'd like for myself and for my kids is to carry that ability to hear someone who isn't my family or of our walk of life's perspective, and to chew on it, even or especially if it makes me or my kids or my partner uncomfortable. And then to just continue to try to plant those little nuggets that might ignite a spark to change.
Right. It's almost like, because you are, I guess I would argue that it's almost easy to not have to be aware of your neighbors. It's almost expected that you think a very specific American patriotic way that maybe not a lot of people necessarily grow up with the perspective to care about others, to understand socioeconomics, to understand race and the complicated nature of race in our country. So when at least in my experience, so many people are like you, where they perhaps know a little bit better, perhaps can see from multiple sides of various arguments. And then that's the work, right? To go back to those communities, to go back to where you're from, literally in your case, to go back to Albuquerque, where we're from, and say, okay, I left. I know a little bit of something about the world. I encountered a bunch of different kinds of people. Let me go back and let me see what it's like to return. And I really value what you're saying about letting your family and your children specifically go back and chew on the things that might differ from how they feel, chew on things that might feel really rudimentary or old school even. Like, tell me a little bit more about that. What do you hope your kids get out of that process?
I hope they become kind individuals who can empathize and who have compassion. Because, I mean, if you take my neighbors as an example, they're not in every regard good people, but they do kind things too. And that's what I want my kids to see. Because I feel like in the world that we live in, we do see people in such black and white terms often, or we see people how they want to be perceived in the world of social media. And if you can see, you know, our neighbor at 6 a.m. this morning when she went to get her paper, bringing our recycling and our trash cans up our driveway because they were still out a day later than they should have been, just to be neighborly. You know, if you can share those experiences, maybe you can find a middle ground on bigger issues, and maybe by being kind to one another, it paves the way for a more civil conversation and treatment of people when you really do have stark differences.
That's such a beautiful thought. And I feel like this natural inclination to push back a little bit. And I'm curious what you think about, like, what does it mean to value the perspective of people who don't value the perspectives of people?
I don't think you can value, or at least in my opinion, I can't value those perspectives. I can try to hear them, and I can try to, I don't want to use the word soften because I think that's a poor way to say it, but I can chip away at what they think and why. If I can use real specific contextual examples and conversation, and I can avoid being combative. I think that the long game is those workarounds. You know, it's sitting down with my neighbors over a beer and talking about education. And when they say something that I disagree with, saying, I see what you're saying, and I think I just think about it a little differently, and hoping that I've kind of put those pennies in our trust bank so that they hear that and they can decide, okay, either I don't vocalize this to her again, or what I hope for is I'm brushing my teeth, I'm getting ready to go to bed, and I'm thinking about what Lara said, and I don't like it, but I keep thinking about it. And maybe slowly over time, that will change what they see and think in the world.
It's almost like, in the same way that you can recognize and reflect on your own change and your own influence from others and varied perspectives, you're hoping to do that same thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, I want to believe, right, that we're not going to head further apart in ideologies, and that people aren't going to continue to be more and more horrible to one another. So until there's hard data that tells me that what I'm doing doesn't work, I want to try to like plant those little seeds of empathy. And I hope my kids see it, you know?
Yeah, I do too. I hope they do too. Especially living in that really dynamic street that really includes all walks of life. It's a really beautiful picture. And I hope too that you are able to affect that change that you hope to affect, not for the sake of change, not for the sake of being right, but for the sake of what I'm hearing you say is really trying to give humanity to a lot more perspectives. And because you look and sound and come from the same background as some of these people, maybe you have an opportunity to do something that others who don't look, don't sound, don't come from the same background as them might not have the opportunity to do.
I guess I hope so. And then I also think, you know, you think about your own bias and there are experiences that I just don't have. I'm very privileged. And while I've had some suffering, it's not akin to the experiences of many, many others. So I probably have a lot more growing to do still.
Well, I appreciate that perspective. I think we all do. And I think that this story is going to help a lot of people reflect on not only their journey as potentially progressive, but how they connect with all different kinds of backgrounds. I think that you're offering a really beautiful look into how we might do that, even just on an airplane. So thank you so much, Laura, for talking with me. This has been super valuable and eye-opening, and it's just been really nice to connect with you again. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm happy that we got to do this, and I hope it gives somebody else something to chew on.
Thanks for listening to Coming Around, a podcast sharing short stories about big change. I'm your host, Joey Torres. This episode is produced by Josh Perez, and the theme music is performed by Set of Lives. Listen for new episodes just about every week, and until next time, remember, if you're not listening, you're not changing.